This is Coast to Coast AM. All right, here we go. We've got Larry Kelly coming up. His book, which I have read and reread, Lessons from Fallen Civilizations. This one is actually, Can a Bankrupt America Survive the Current Islamic Threat? But we'll touch on that and ever so much more as we go through the night. We're going to talk about Benghazi. I'm sorry, but we're going to talk about Benghazi. It's serious. And also things like how the U.S. looks to the rest of the world when Russia comes in to save the day regarding Syria, when our Secretary of Defense, that would be John Kerry, who was just a very vocal anti-war kind of guy, is just falling all over himself to get over there because they're killing their own people. The U.S. never does that, does it? Did I call him Secretary of State of Defense? He's Secretary of State in the OL, Secretary of, never mind. Larry Kelly, come on to the program again. It's been a long time since we spoke back in January. It's good to have you back.
Thank you very much, John, for having me on. You know, I have to tell you, we continue to get coast-to-coast listeners coming to our website, and we even have continued to see a flurry of really nice reviews from coast-to-coast listeners on the Amazon site. So I really need to thank you personally and your coast-to-coast listeners.
They are, I'm telling you, they are the best listeners on this or any other planet. And thank you, because obviously you've brought something very valuable to the, to our party. And,
thank you. And so
the response speaks for itself. You know, Larry has written scores of columns on the dangers of Western complacency. And, in his tenure as a political commentary writer, he's made a significant impact. His feature articles have appeared in the Piedmont Post, San Francisco Chronicle, Human Events, Town Hall Magazine. Two of his articles are featured on the cover of Town Hall Magazine. He wrote an opposing editorial, which appeared in the liberal San Francisco Chronicle a month before President Obama was inaugurated, entitled A Second New Deal is a Recipe for Disaster. And then 2.5 years later, on the 6th of August, 2011, the Chronicle ran the front page headline, S&P downgrades U.S. credit rating. So Larry's on top of it. So, you know, it was interesting that somebody sent an email that said, why do you always mention Benghazi? And we're going to talk about Benghazi. I don't notice that much has changed other than the confusion level has risen.
Well, the Blaze actually asked me to write a piece on what I see as having changed since the Benghazi attacks. And there are, you know, some things that we do know. There are some things, of course, that we don't. We know for sure that an Al-Qaeda affiliate with high-powered, sophisticated weaponry attacked the embassy. And we know that President Obama and various people in his administration lied about the origin of that attack for quite some time. We know that no rescue party was sent. And so there are, you know, things that are still being hidden from view. For example, there were a number of people, survivors, that were there that have been cloistered and not allowed to testify. For example, there's a David Eubin is his name, and he was on the roof. He saw Tyrone Woods and one of the other fatalities, Tyrone Woods and Glenn Doherty, killed. And he suffered a very serious wound. And so we need to know from him what his take on it was and why there was a stand-down order. They've been saying for the longest time that there was no stand-down order, but an assistant Lieutenant Colonel S.E. Gibson reportedly had earlier said, you know, that there was no point of order to stand down, but rather to remain in Tripoli to defend the American embassy there. Well, an order to remain in Tripoli sounds to me, John, like a stand-down order. Who gave
it
and why?
Now, this man that you mentioned that observed the two SEALs, were they ex-SEALs or were they in current duty as SEALs?
They were ex. Okay. Tyrone Woods and Glenn Doherty.
Yeah.
And
so they
disobeyed orders, although they were not strictly speaking military, they were contractors with SEAL experience.
I got you.
They disobeyed and went.
And the man who observed this, those men being, those ex-SEALs being lost, is he the one that laid on the roof for hours and days and whatever, waiting for somebody to show up and he was bad wounded?
Yeah, we even know his name now. It's David Ubin. And I think he is still in the hospital, Walter Reed. But so that's, you know, can you imagine if George Bush had was responsible for something like that, to cloistering people, keeping them away from the press and whatever else they're doing to intimidate these people. I mean, you know, people...
I understand there were some... Is there anything to... You know, the rumors just abound everywhere, but I've heard that people were going to... There were some high-ranking military officers that were going in anyway, and they were arrested. Is there anything to substantiate these claims and rumors?
That I don't have not heard.
I'll get into a little bit further, and we'll discuss it at some future point. But I understand that some military men, some high-ranking military men, were going to make a move, and their junior officers arrested them. Now, I don't know if that's a fact. I'm just saying that it's out there on the net, and it's growing in popularity. So anyway, just take it where you want to go. I don't understand why no one's been called to account. I don't understand why when Secretary Clinton was called before a congressional panel. At first it was a bump on the head, and then it was a stomach ache and everything else, and it wound up with, at this point, what difference does it make? I didn't find that to be a satisfactory answer at all.
Yeah, I actually wrote a little piece about it, and, you know, perhaps that that statement will prevent her from ever being commander-in-chief. It certainly will be, if she is the nominee sometime down the road, that statement will be, I know we will hear it over and over again in campaign ads.
Well, let me ask you something. You know, I quote you from your book on occasion, particularly Immutable Law Number 1, which is that no civilization has survived once the citizenry has decided it's not worth saving. And I'm just wondering if this this failure to press our government officials on what are clearly falsehoods that they've presented to the public, that stupid video on the Benghazi thing, and just all of this nonsense covering up, and then the attorney general just, you know, he makes a move. It's not a good move. He gets caught in it and just walks like he's coated with Teflon. Has the citizenry given up on trying to bring their government representatives to account?
No, but what I think has happened, what one thing that has happened that has changed, and I say in the wake of Benghazi and other failures, is that there are now rank and file military, as well as senior military, that are letting it be known through various channels that they will not go to war with this commander in chief to defend an Al Qaeda, you know, a riddled army of rebels in Syria. And there's if your listeners go to my website, you can see there's a picture that went viral, and it's a highly decorated picture of a highly decorated Navy man, and he has a sign in front of his face that says, "I didn't join the Navy to fight for Al Qaeda in a Syrian civil war." And you can see this vast row of medals this guy has, but his face is covered. Apparently that has gone viral, and there are senior military officials that are also, I think this is rather unprecedented, making it known that it is becoming the case that President Obama's ability to be commander-in-chief is beginning to be impugned.
Yeah, I'm just wondering what this whole setup was for. It's clear that Libya and Syria are tied together. It's clear to me that it is. Now, can I prove it? Can I connect these dots? No, but they're not just dots. They're little flashing spots on the radar screen, and it just looks like something was going on behind the scenes that triggered this attack on the embassy as a diversion from what was actually happening, because the Syrian situation was shortly to follow. And I think it has to do with, I thought it then, and I think it was all about an arms deal. And then that popped up on the scope for a while, and then they kind of quieted it down a little bit. So,
That's definitely out there. There was also a rumor that there was going to be a deal brokered to return the blind sheikh who Morsi and the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt consider a you know, almost a patron saint, and that there were negotiations going on in that regard with arms and so forth. So that, yeah, there are still a lot of rumors that are going around, and you know, the military ethos is that never leave anyone behind. Even if you're in a firefight, even if you're certain that your comrade has been killed, you will go back and bring his body out for his family. That is the ethos. So when Panetta, when he's being interrogated about Benghazi, he said, "Well, we didn't send anybody because, you know, it was so, the situation was so unknown." Come on,
right?
An absurd statement.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, tell you what, I hear the creepy music in the background, which means our commercials are being staged. But when we come back, I give the people an idea of how you're effectively a geopolitical analyst, as well as an internal analyst of some of the antics that are going on within our current civilization. So we'll get into all that when we come back. Well, Larry, bring us up to speed here. You've been doing this for a long time, and you have you're primarily a political commentary writer, but you know, that sort of makes it sound like it's within the borders of the U.S. But, you know, as the U.S. continues to expand into other people's territory and involve them in our agenda, I suppose it's become a more of a global, a geopolitical commentary thing that you do.
I would tell your listeners that I write a form of political commentary called comparative history, where if I criticize something that I see that our commander-in-chief is doing, for example, I think you, the reader, have the right to say, well, based on what? Well, based on historic precedent. And so that's why I think that comparative history is really the queen of political commentary. I did want to piggyback on one thing that you said before the break, John. You said, you know, ultimately we have the power. I don't know to what extent the military letting people know that they would not support an attack on Syria. But I do know that what Ted Cruz said the other day, your senator there, he said that when it looked like we were headed for a strike on Syria, the calls that came in to his office, he said, were overwhelming. And they were overwhelming, 100-1, he said, against. And that's what shut down the attack.
Yep. Brzezinski said it himself. Alternative media is what stalled the attack.
Yeah. So that's a what I've said in the end of my book is that, yes, we're in decline, and that the world is becoming more dangerous because of our insouciance, our weakness, showing weakness rather than strength. And essentially what we've been doing for at least this past year, but maybe longer than that, is we've been emboldening our enemies while we appear to be betraying our friends. And so that's just something that, you know, can't go on forever. That is a real recipe for I think, catastrophic future. One of the phrases I coined somewhere along the way is that I've said, unlike the British Empire, we, meaning the American Empire, will not have the luxury of going quietly into the night. We simply have too many enemies.
Yeah, I'm afraid so. And you know, Vladimir Putin, now get this. Russia will defend national identity based on religious values. This is from Putin. This is a quote. We believe that it is natural and appropriate to defend those values. Any minority deserves respect for its distinctive identity, but the rights of the majority must not be questioned, Putin said during a meeting of the Valdai Discussion Club. He believes that Russia can't move forward without cultural and national self-determination. Otherwise, the country won't be able to respond to external or internal challenges, can't be successful in global competition. So what sort of a position is the U.S. in when Vlad Putin rides into the rescue to just go, wait, on this Syria thing? I mean, he's looking like the good guy now.
Yeah, and I think it's a ruse. I couldn't say for sure, but I think, you know, this latest initiative was just a misstatement, the result of a misstatement, a kind of a gaffe that Kerry made and that Putin seized upon. And I just think that the whole arrangement is flawed on so many levels. I don't think it's workable. For one thing, it's you're in a war zone. How are we going to protect the supposed weapons inspectors? The timeline is certainly to just fall apart. It's also an expensive proposition. I don't even think we have the money to dispose of all of their weapons. We've been disposing of our weapons over the last 20 years, and it's run into the $10 billion or so dollars. And it's just, there are so many things about the arrangement that I think, looking at it realistically, it's simply a delaying tactic. It's the same kind of thing that the Iranians have been doing with their nuclear programs. Just one more, you know, just a delaying tactic in order for Assad to survive and for Putin to, he just seems to enjoy practically making us, you know, look ridiculous in the eyes of the rest of the world.
Well, so we have a foreign policy that's clearly on the rocks. We have, all these veterans all these suicides among our veterans. I'm beginning to think this is one gigantic psychological operation that's intended to bring our civilization down. I mean, I can't imagine that this is just a convenient convergence of mistakes, which on their own would be bad enough. But when you have so many of them happening at the same time, it just doesn't bode well for the nation as a whole. This combined with the economic problems. I mean, we are seeing the debt clock every day of our lives for I don't know how many, what, a couple of years, longer than that. Now we don't hardly see it at all. So I'm just wondering what's going on here. You know?
Yeah. Well, the welfare state is expanding through exponentially. I think the total recipients of food stamps in 2000 was something under 10 million. Now it's 50 million. And the food stamp program is, I think it's up to something like 70, 80 billion, and it's one of 50 welfare agencies, welfare programs, if you will,
right.
Assistance programs. And from time to time, I'll mention to somebody that I have a book out and the person will say, oh, that's interesting. What's the title? And I'll tell them the title. And then I'll often get, John, the question that amounts to something like, well, are we doomed? To which I say, by my reading of history, you cannot have a world-class welfare state and a world-class military. You might have neither, but you can't have both.
Isn't that the truth? Yeah, that's pretty well. I didn't see that one coming, but there's just so much of it out there. Here's an email, for example. You stated that this comes from Michael. You stated you don't know why no one has been held accountable. I'll tell you why. There's no proof of any wrongdoing. That's why. The problem with you, John, is that you and others like you don't want to believe that there is no scandal. It's like, how do you reason with people who think this way? It's like, if there's no scandal, if you can't see there's a scandal here, I don't know what it would take to indicate to you that there's a scandal.
Yeah. At some point, you know, when I get into conversations with people that are on the ideological other side of the spectrum from me, and I'll just sort of throw up my hands and say, well, I guess the sky is green, too. In other words, sometimes people will just hold on to a position that, you know, you can't argue with it. It's just, I don't want to just sound as though I'm berating our president, because nobody in the country wants to see the president do poorly on the world stage. Nobody benefits from that.
No, we all look bad.
But you really need to think about what he has said, and that is that he came into office thinking that the American hegemony in the Middle East was dangerous and bad and needed to be reduced. And second of all, that the Iraq war was a horrific mistake. And he's made that pretty clear in his statements, you know, all the way along. And so I think what's surprising him and many of his supporters is, as we appear to be unable to direct events or control events in a region where we used to have much more influence, it's getting a lot messier than they planned, than he could have imagined. So that it's a plot. I think Barack Obama has basically had said, even as a candidate, that he believed that our military presence, especially in the Middle East, was the problem.
Yeah. Well, you know, and Iran is still the target. Ultimately, yeah. Iran is still the target. And you've done some. You've done an interview with. We did an interview with some Iranian resistance fighters.
Yes.
You don't hear much about an Iranian resistance.
You sure don't, and that's a real failing, I think, of our press. You know, particularly going back to we did see very early in the Obama's presidency a violent reaction. There were millions of people that came out to the streets. They called it the Green Revolt, and they had, you know, the kind of numbers that the Egyptians used to bring down Mubarak. But of course, you know, they're totally disarmed, and the regime has not only do they have an army, they're called the Quds Force, and the Revolutionary Guards, but they also have another whole force of people. They call them the Basiji, and these are what a lot of totalitarian regimes have, and these are just thugs on motor scooters that ride into the crowds and, you know, club people and beat them up and so forth.
Right.
And so there was a moment in time when the regime could have been brought down very early in Barack Obama's presidency, and I think he was still thinking that his ability to reason with the mullahs would be preferable than a messy revolution where we would back the rebels. But it's important for our listeners to know, if they don't know this, that right after 9/11, 9/12, whereas there was a lot of celebrations in various Islamic capitals, in Tehran, the people came out and they held a candlelight vigil for those that had lost their lives, and even the regime tried to get them to disperse, and they wouldn't. So the thing to understand about Iran, the regime in Tehran, if you think of the radical militant Islamic movement that's Al Qaeda and has spawned so many other movements now in the Middle East and elsewhere.
Yeah.
You think of that as the spear. The people running Tehran are the spear tip. They're behind it all. That they will finance even Al Qaeda, even though they're fighting Al Qaeda now in Syria. It's also a Shiite Sunni civil war there for the control of that country. They will also at other times, you know, the real objective is to destroy Israel and to bring the U.S. under the black flag of Islam. And so that's just something that we need to understand. And so this interview that I was able to get, it became a piece that I wrote for Human Events magazine back in 2006. And I made the acquaintance of a woman by the name of Roya. And she fled, she and her family fled Iran in when the Shah fell in 79, when she was a little girl.
Yeah.
And what she does today is she's a human rights advocate. And because she has friends, family still there, and of course she's still fluent in Farsi, people contact her and they let her know, oh, my daughter's been taken into prison. You know, she's being held. We're fearing for her life and so forth. And what Roya does then is she goes to human rights organizations and various press outlets and gets this woman's picture and her story, you know, circulating into diplomatic circles and to various other agencies and to news, and tries to get these people out. Well, one of the benefits to that is also it destabilizes the regime. It makes the regime look as evil as it really is. And so what she was able to do, there were two resistance fighters. Both of them had been at various times imprisoned, and we were able to, through satellite phone, contact them in hiding. They were moving, you know, from safe house to safe house, and they gave this interview. And one of the things that I wanted to find out in the interview, John, was if this is when George Bush is still president. I mean, this is 2 years into George Bush's second term. And I wanted to find out if he were to take out the nuclear sites, would the conventional wisdom be correct? Conventional wisdom being that it would unite the country against us.
Yeah.
Or would it not? Would it perhaps destabilize the regime? Well, that's exactly what both of these guys said. We are praying for the strikes. We would welcome them. We think it would bring the regime down. We need help. We need communications. We can't pull off a revolt unless we have communications equipment. We need some help in that regard. Maybe some weapons shipments and so on. Because about 80%, they say, of the Iranians hate the regime. They're sick and tired of it.
And they would actually welcome a strike?
Yes.
Wow. Well, that's what I hear from some of these young adults who are, you know, they consider themselves Persians. They're Iranian, but they say, mm-hmm. we're Persians, you know. They say young people aren't interested in this stuff. We don't like it at all.
Well, they understand that their culture is much older than Islam. You know, Islam was imposed by the sword very brutally in 640. But the Persians, you know, they trace their culture far, far behind that. But yeah. Before that, I should say, excuse me. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of them are, you know, nationalist in that, and I can't say this for sure, but if the regime were to fall, perhaps the majority of the people would even leave Islam.
Now, there's an interesting thought. Larry Kelly is our guest tonight. Talking to him again after having had the opportunity to do so back in January, his book, Lessons from Fallen Civilizations. We'll be right back.